We left off Perek Yudches Pasuk Tes. So the top of page Resh Dalid. And Perek Yudches Pasuk Tes, 18:9. Gam misrape bimalachto, ochu leva al mashchis. Also someone who's lazy in his work, he is a brother to someone who is a destroyer. What does that mean? Right? So Rashi Kidarko gives an interpretation which makes the center on the words of Torah. Gam misrape b'malachto, poresh min ha-Torah v'hu Talmud Chacham. Someone who is a Talmud Chacham, I guess Talmud Chacham in this sense meaning someone who's learned, right, but certainly he doesn't have the personal qualities of a Talmud Chacham. He's a learned person, but at a certain point he just, you know, wakes up one morning and says, "Ah, forget about it. You know, I'm going to separate myself from the words of Torah. You know, I'm going to, it's not for me." So he's misrape b'malachto. He had a certain malach, he had a certain job in life. You know, that was his job to be a Talmud Chacham, and he slacked off. So he is a brother to a Baal Mashchis, says Rashi. Who's the Baal Mashchis? The destroyer, L'Satan. Right? In other words, In a sense, says Rashi, the worst kind of rejection of Torah is a betrayal of Torah. Right? It's worse, in a sense, to be the Talmud Chacham who, you know, chucks it all over the side than the guy who never had it, because the guy who never had it, the guy who was never into it, you know, what do you want from him at the end of the day? The guy who was there, you know, the Elusha ben Abuya of the world, you know, the guy who was there and he was in it and he was, you know, teaching it and whatnot, and then he decides, nah, I'm not interested. He's on the worst madrega, and you know one can theorize for among other reasons. Rashi doesn't say this, but the effect that person has on others is a profoundly disturbing effect. I mean, people say, look, you know, John Doe is not into learning, you know, not into shmiras on mitzvahs. Okay, meila, you know, but this guy was a Rosh Hashiva. You know, and he gave it all up. Oh, you know, you see that, you know, it's really not a life which is worth pursuing. Right? You know, a person like that there's a tremendous fallout in terms of others.
Fortunately, don't we say, Rabbi Ram, that's highly unusual.
Yeah, right. I don't think we see it all that much, but, you know, but...
Does it happen?
Wasn't it Kohen Gadol, I think?
Yeah, Yochanan Kohen Gadol, the Gemara says that he served for 80 years. And then became a tzduki, became a Sadducee at the very end of his life.
He took a hike.
Right, yeah, basically. And, you know, there are these safe stories. I mean, the classic story is Elisha ben Abuya, the Gemara Achir. The Mishnayos talk about someone who was a Tana, was a, you know, contemporary, a colleague of Rabbi Akiva, and somehow just, you know, lost it. And you know, went over to the side of the Romans. I mean, became, you know, not just a you know, not just someone who disagreed with Judaism in a philosophical sense, but also, you know, helped out the enemy against the Jewish people.
They still quote him in Pirkei Avos, though.
Right? Yeah. He still made it in, but I guess the point over there,
something for him. I don't know.
Right. There, I think the impression I always had was that was before he left, and we say, look, if it's good words of Torah, we'll take it from wherever it comes.
He became an ish acher.
Right.
So it's a
right.
It's
he
a
became
guy.
A different person.
But
right.
Is this a comment on, like, you do have examples of people who renounce their, well, they don't renounce their Yiddishkeit, but I don't know what they do, but they become like enemies. They become enemies of Yiddishkeit. Right. It's like the example you just gave, but they're people like, you know, like Bobby Fischer, the chess player,
right.
You know, Cat Stevens, the singer. These right. people were born Jewish, and then they become like the most virulent anti-Zionists, anti-Jewish.
Yeah, I think by extension, I mean, I don't know if Rashi's talking about that directly, but I think by extension, it's a similar kind of idea. You know, the worst feeling is, you know, the feeling of betrayal.
Yeah.
You know, the guy was in the thick
of it in the first place.
That's also
people
true.
Who you... They were right. never part of it.
No, they weren't. I know, that's what I'm thinking.
So
that's
they were just superficial. They don't know what it's all about.
They were like
just
kind of caught
up in the trend.
They right. they were part of the nation of Israel. They weren't part of the. They never were.
They didn't have the hashkafa.
Right.
You define misrapim lachto as lazy, someone's lazy?
Misrapim means a slacker. Rafa means weak. Someone who weakens in his work. Right? So someone who slacks off in his work is considered to be a brother to a destroyer. The Malbim in his commentary relates this to things other than Torah directly, and also I think addresses the issue of the issue you raise with misrape. Misrape means literally like slacking off or weakening. It's not as strong a term as the one that Rashi introduces, Poresh Minatar. Poresh Minatar means, you close the door and you walk away. Misrapi Mimalachto sounds like, instead of coming to the Kailal at, bright and early at 9, right, the guy comes in at 11.
Schedule.
Right.
That's all.
He
learns less.
Right.
But he doesn't give it up completely.
Right. That's the That's the Poshet of Pshat. We'll see the Malbim goes with that approach, to a much greater extent than Rashi. Because again, in Rashi, Poresh min ha-Torah makes it sound like you're leaving it entirely, right? If you look in the Malbim, however, in the Malbim, in the wide lines, it's six lines down. Right, a person is hired to do work for the kingdom. The echad bona es habinyon v'hishchisa. Right, and you have two people who are both hired to do work for the kingdom. Right, one builds the building and then destroys it, and one of them sits on the side and doesn't do anything. They will be punished equally, says the Malbim. Right, because either way, you could say one of them was more proactive because he built it and destroyed it, and the other one did nothing.
One's more lahachis. He actually got it up and then he destroys it.
Right.
And that, I would think, is worse than someone who, tallying lackadaisical, never got focused and did nothing.
Right.
He actually destroyed what he was supposed to do.
Right. So that's what we would think. So the Malbim is bringing out from the Pasuk that, no, on a certain level at least, again, I'll leave his assessment of government punishment up to him, but, on a certain level, the government is going to punish them equally, because in the end of the day, in terms of results, they have the same lack of results. The guy who just slacked off and sat on the side and drank lemonade the whole day and, played cards and whatnot, he's an ach, he's a colleague to the Baal Mashkis, the one who came and actually destroyed the building. Similarly, v'chein ein hevdel ben misha osa mitzvos v'osa aveiro shemechabe mitzvos v'hishchis. So too, there's no difference between someone who does mitzvos but also does aveiros, which negate the the power of that mitzvah. There's no difference between that person and somebody who basically says, I'm neutral, I don't do mitzvahs, I don't do averos. Sheshneim lo also esamutal aleim. Neither one has done what's being demanded of them. In other words, if you look at a bottom line kind of perspective, the bottom line is going to be zero, whether you do mitzvahs and then cancel them out with averos, or you just decide to do nothing. What I think the Malbim is talking about in a broader sense is he's trying to dispel the notion that a lot of us have that sitting passively on the sidelines when you're needed is acceptable, right? In other words, what's bad? Bad is proactively doing something bad. But a sin of omission, just doing nothing when the times call for it, that just means I'm not being heroic. I don't have to be heroic. Let the heroes be heroic.
Interested in lifting Mishur Saddin.
Right, so that's what you would think. In other words, you'd think it's just a lifting Mishur Saddin thing, meaning as long as I'm a good person, I'm not harming anybody, I don't have to proactively go out of my way to do what's right. And essentially, what the Malbim is bringing out is that that's really a very wrong attitude. It's a very easy attitude to fall into, right? But it's a very wrong attitude. When you see something happening which is wrong, which demands your participation, which demands your getting involved, which demands your taking a stand. You're not taking a stand, you're shying away from it. You're ultimately no different than the guy who proactively is doing the wrongdoing, because lemaisa, the result is going to be the same. you know, again, the Holocaust comes to mind as a terrific example, unfortunately, right? I mean, clearly, you know, the Germans were the proactive ones in terms of the mass murder of the Jews. They were the Bali Mashchis. But, you know, on a certain level, the rest of the nations of the world that basically just said, look, we don't want to get involved. You know, even America, you know, where America basically said, look, you know, we can't accept refugees. We're going to have to turn them back. We, you know, it goes against our quota. Or we can't bomb Auschwitz because that would interfere with, you know, the rest of the war plans that we have. You know, so you're misrapping the Malachto. You're not doing anything wrong. I mean, you're not, I'm sorry?
With Pearl Harbor also the same way.
In what sense?
You know, they saw it coming and they did nothing until they knew that the Japs were going to do something.
Right. Well, there, I mean, they say Roosevelt wanted to enter the war and he wanted to basically have an excuse, you know, so you let Pearl Harbor happen. Right. But I'm talking just in terms of the Holocaust, the mass murder of the Jews. So, you know, who's more guilty for that? The German Nazis or the Swiss, who just kind of said, look, we don't take a position. You know, so the Swiss, I'm sure, would pat themselves on the back and say, look, we're neutral. You know, don't come to us with tainas. That's the way we are. We're neutral. We don't take positions. Sometimes being neutral and not taking a position is achul of al mashchis. It's pretty much the same thing as actually going out and doing the avera. Because if you stand by and you don't get involved, and you know you just let things go on, you're as guilty, basically, the pasuk says, as the one who actually goes and does the destroying himself. Bottom line, your lack of participation is what allows this atrocity to happen. Had the world stood up, you know, to the Nazis and said, you know, this is atrocious, this is terrible, we can't allow this to go on, you know, they wouldn't have been able on their own to have accomplished everything that they were able to accomplish. You know, so the pasuk really brings out, not just in Torah, not just in mitzvahs and averos, but in everything in life, standing on the sidelines is not acceptable. You know, it's just as bad as the sin itself.
But halachically, someone who doesn't do a mitzvah, is that, as I thought, we judge makafsepus, there's no onish. I mean, until he actually does avera versus a guy who has a machshava to do bad, he gets an onish for that.
No, there is a concept of bitul mitzvah aseh. So in other words, if a guy, you know, one morning says, you know, I'm not going to do this positive mitzvah, that's a demerit, you know, that gets added to his account up in Shemayim. In fact, one of the things that we confess on Yom Kippur is, you know, the bitul mitzvah aseh, which we've done.
But according to the Malbim, that he doesn't cut that, the person that's lack of bitul mitzvah aseh, just if he doesn't do a mitzvah, it's almost as bad as not, it's the equivalent to having done an avera, which is really pushing.
Well, it is an avera, it's an avera of bitul mitzvah aseh.
But it's not the same thing of going on being Mechal Shabbos.
No, okay. I mean, there are different levels of averos.
That's what I'm saying. But he's clumping it all together as a teaching, or he really believes that all mitzvahs and all the lack of doing a mitzvah is the equivalent of doing avera.
Well, yes, with the proviso that there are different madregas, even in the world of averos. In other words, going out and killing somebody is not the same madrega as stealing something. Right, so in other words, even within proactive averus, you have different levels. So the bitul mitzvah saseh comes on a lower level than many of, you know, violating many of the lavin. But, you know, so I think, you know, you would have to refine what he says a little bit. I think the Malbim himself would be maskim that there has to be some refinement in terms of the mitzvah versus avera thing. But the point he's bringing out is that sometimes, you know, not doing anything is just as bad as, you know, doing something and then, you know, counteracting it in a certain way. The Mitzvot David brings this back to Talmud Torah, and, you know, but in a similar fashion as does the Malbim. If you look at the Mitzvot David, Gam Misrapi, the first line, Afilu ha-mis'atzel b'melechas ha-Torah u'refuya hi biyado. Right here, the Mitzvot David really focuses on the word Misrapi. You know, in the, you know, I think the easiest way to understand it, someone who's lazy, you know, a person who, he learns, but he slacks off in his learning of Torah. You know, he's just not giving it his all. Urefuya hi biyado, and the possession that he has on Torah is a very weak one. It's not strong in his hands. Ach v'chaver l'misha mashchis es divrei ha-Torah b'deyos kosvos. Such a person who slacks off is considered to be a colleague of someone who destroys Torah proactively with, you know, with heretical points of view. Why? Ki sofo yihye kamohu kasher yishkach divrei haTorah. Because ultimately, when this person forgets the Torah that he's learned, he's going to be just as bad as this person who starts off with a heretical viewpoint vis-a-vis Torah.
This notion of rebuking somebody.
Yeah.
I don't know, the Mesudas David doesn't say it as much as the Malbim, and I was just going to make the point on the Malbim for a second. I mean, it's a very touchy topic, rebuking somebody.
Yeah.
Not
for the
faint of heart. Yeah, it isn't for the faint of heart. I mean, for example, Lahavdil, completely Lahavdil, but let's say take Eretz Yisrael, or Israel, the nation of Am Yisrael in the United Nations. There's no problem with all these non-Jewish interested countries and nations rebuking Israel because they think they're in the right. They like, you know, jump on the bandwagon like in a split second. They have no problem rebuking as, you know, what Israel does for security, what Israel does
for anything.
Yeah. And so there's an example like Lahavdil where people are they rush to judgment and they're wrong. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, stam wrong.
Right.
I can't think of it. It's very touchy in the workplace, in personal relationships. It's a very touchy situation to rebuke, to...
No, absolutely. The way I would take most of these statements in Mishlei is, you know, lessons that we're supposed to learn for ourselves. One can say that, let's say in the case of the United Nations, certainly there's a tremendous degree of hypocrisy in nations. You know, Libya is going to tell the Jew, you know, Libya is going to tell Israel how to be exemplars of human rights. I mean, it's a little bit of a joke. It's a lot of a joke, unfortunately. Yeah. But, in Mishlei, basically, Shlomo HaMelech is speaking to us. And he's saying, look, you know, whatever you are with other people, you got to be honest with yourself. And, you know, you have to be honest with yourself and tell yourself what's right and what's wrong and try to live up to that yourself as much as is possible. You know, I mean, yes, in rebuking other people, there's always a lot of room for hypocrisy, right? But, you know, the place to start is with yourself. They say from Rabbi Saul Salanter, you know, he said when he was young, he thought that he would go out and change the entire world. Then he realized that was a little unrealistic, so he said, you know, let me go out and change my city. Then he realized that was unrealistic, and then he said, let me change my neighborhood. That's a little unrealistic. I'll change my family. And finally, he said, you know, that's very unrealistic. Halavai, I should be able to change myself, and then I will have accomplished something. So, you know, again, we do have a concept of rebuke, of tochach, of trying to help other people see that as well. But the starting point, the way I would take most of these statements in Mishlei is, you know, lessons to the self. Mm-hmm. You know, start with how we're supposed to see ourselves and, you know, what's right and what's wrong. Now, you look at this Mitzvah's David, I mean, to be frank, you know, there's a part of us, I think, that says he's maybe overstating the case a little bit. I mean, come on, the guy who shows up to yeshiva at 11 as opposed to 9 is in the same category as someone who's spouting heretical, you know, points of view on Torah. You know, to put it in somewhat, you know, contemporary terms, you got to compare a yeshiva guy who sleeps in late with a guy who's missionizing, you know, to something else. I mean, doesn't that sound like a little bit of a stretch? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, on a certain level, but let me put it in the following terms. I think we can appreciate it. The hardest people to do kiruv with are people who have something of a yeshiva background. It's oftentimes much easier to be makariv somebody to Yiddishkeit when they start with a totally blank slate, or a virtually totally blank slate. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you can really show them, in a real sense, what Torah means and why it's meaningful and why it's beautiful and why, you know, they should want to embrace it. And, you know, when they're ready for it, they buy it. Let's say, but what often happens is you have a guy who went, you know, even to 12 years of yeshiva day school, and he didn't really put too much into his limudei kodesh while he was there. And, you know, like many people, unfortunately, he moves after, you know, the 12 years of yeshiva day school kind of drifts away from observance. It's extremely hard to get that guy back because he thinks he knows. And if he thinks he knows, nothing you're going to tell him is going to be able to convince him that, you know, that he doesn't really know, that really what he experienced was, you know, a very childish view, you know, and a half-baked view of Torah and mitzvahs, which, you know, which he's walking around now with for the rest of his life. So that, I think, if you take that fact, I mean, and you put that into the mitzvahs David, I think it helps us understand it. A guy who's misasab umlechas ha-Torah fu yehu biyado, you know, a guy who had some exposure, but he didn't bother really getting to the depths of Torah, trying to understand it. You know, basically, yeah, what's Torah all about? Yeah, you know, we can't watch TV on Shabbos and we stone to death children who, you know, who disagree with their parents. Yeah, that's what I remember more or less from my exposure to yeshiva education. So that guy is the most susceptible to the Deus Kosmos, you know, to really falling into, you know, because he didn't put the time into understanding Torah properly. He rejects it, you know, out of this lack of understanding, and it's extraordinarily hard to bring him back, because, you know, he thinks he knows it already. In a sense, had he not even learned, he would be in a better position to be able to understand Torah than, you know, than this guy who, you know, took it, yeah, I passed the tests, you know, I did what I had to do. But, yeah, I think the whole religion is a joke. You know, he doesn't have, you know, really a positive sense about the religion, again, because he didn't really invest himself in trying to understand it on any level. Right? So that's,
well, I mean, the Rambam wrote Moed Avuchem because apparently his Talmidim were checking out Aristotle and everything.
So, right, but in a sense, it's easier.
They had alien thoughts.
But you know what? It's easier to deal with that than the guy who just doesn't care. In other words, if a guy really cares and he wants to check out Aristotle because, you know, he's bothered by, you know, maybe Aristotle has something of the truth, and I want to try to reconcile that with Torah, you can have a conversation with him because he's a seeker. The guy that Shlomo HaMelech, I think, is talking about is someone that I've encountered in many, many contexts, including the classroom. You know, Rabbi, you know, I want to go watch MTV. You know, what are you hacking me above a comma? You know, what are you making me crazy? You know, I don't care. You know, so a guy like that who doesn't care, it's very, very hard to get through to him in any real way. And sooner or later, he'll come to Deus Kosmos, you know, to a heretical way of looking at the world, because that enables him to justify. Well, it enables him to justify not caring, you know, because otherwise he would have to explain to himself how is it that, you know, I'm enrolled in a yeshiva and I'm not actually giving it my all, that I don't, well, you know, the reason I don't care about this is because it's all silly, it's all stupid, it doesn't make any sense anyway, so, you know. So his what starts off as laziness, you know, and a lack of desire to apply himself very quickly metamorphosizes into a rejection of the whole system on ideological grounds, or what he thinks are ideological grounds.
I've always found that when I'm like in a yeshiva environment, it inspires me to do more.
Right, which is good.
Yeah.
And that's the way it's supposed to be. And I would say precisely because you don't come with any preconceived notions, the yeshiva experience is a beautiful experience.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the way it works is sometimes Davka, the person who, you know, grows up with it and doesn't realize how beautiful it is, you know, finds it constricting and finds it tiresome and, yeah, you know, wears it out. And
I've asked you this question before. I don't recall the precise answer, but I think you said something about it. Halacha is consonant with Torah itself. Halacha is Torah. But I think the differentiating aspect of the guy who one differentiating aspect, he may also not steig as much in his Gemara and he may not learn as much, but one differentiating aspect between the guy who throws off the yoke of Torah and the guy who doesn't is all contained in the one word of halacha. Does one follow halacha and one doesn't follow halacha?
Right. No, so I think what the Mitzvot David at least is describing is a process. I mean, you're right, 100%. The guy, I don't think the Mitzvot David would say the guy who overslept one day and came to Seder at 11 as opposed to 9. Oh, that's it, you know. That guy's an Epicurus, you know. Let's stone him to death. I find it hard to imagine, despite the fact that some people might disagree, but I find it hard to imagine the Mitzvot David would say such an extreme thing. But, you know, the guy who consistently comes at 11 is on a downward slide, which may take him off of the path of Judaism. Right now, he's still Shomer Halacha.
Yeah.
But I know tons of people who have stopped being Shomer Halacha mostly because of laziness. Mm-hmm. Mostly because of laziness. Not because they're not ideologically committed to it. You know, on a certain level, they think it's the right thing to do. They think that a person should be Shomer Shabbos. But you know what? It's hard. And when they, you know, when it starts, you know, when it starts being hard and you're too lazy to follow through with it, all of a sudden you find yourself after a while in a place where now you're not ideologically committed to the system either. Right? I mean, I could tell you stories, unfortunately. In many cases, they've come back. Because at a certain point they realize, you know, wait, this is ridiculous. You know, I gave myself up. I'm not a person. I'm not the person I was anymore. You know, but in certain cases they let it all slip away. And again, not through any fireworks. It's just, you know, they stop doing this and they stop doing this and they're not as careful about this and they're not as careful about that. And you know, it just kind of builds up to the point where the person just doesn't have anything anymore.
Yeah. They tell a story about there was two chavrusas, and one apparently was mushba from this is in Europe.
Yeah.
And he was mushba from he was influenced by socialism, communism, whatever was going on, and he became alienated from the yeshiva. And so they, you know, he still lived in the same village where the yeshiva was. And he became like Machal Shabbos, right? So one day they used to have these huts where in a shtetl they lived in. All right, so he was sitting by his window on Shabbos, and he was he had a cigar in one hand and he had a gemara in the other hand, and his chavrusa from the yeshiva days walks by and he says, "Hey, Reuven, Tistira." It's a contradiction. So he says, no, it's not a contradiction. He says, das is Geschmack and das is Geschmack. So how does he fit into this?
Yeah. So, I mean, the truth is whatever. I mean, you know, I guess on a certain level it's better that he's learning the Gemara than he's not learning the Gemara, but certainly, you know, that's not the ideal that that the Torah has in mind for the person, you know, that you find it geschmack. I mean, it is geschmack,
yeah.
But it's also supposed to be a religious vehicle to coming close to God. And, you know, clearly that aspect, you know, wasn't there. It was an enjoyable intellectual pursuit, you know, but it didn't really translate into anything beyond that for him.
All right.
Let's take a look at Yud. Migdal Oz, Shem Hashem. The name of God is a tower of strength for a person. Bo yorutz tzadik v'niskaf. A tzadik and an elevated person is able to run with the Shem Hashem, with God's name. Right? Now, what's the chiddush over here? In other words, it's good to be connected to God. Okay, granted, I think we would all agree to that. You know, what exactly is the chiddush over here? The Mesudas David writes something interesting. If you look, the first white line, Migdal, Mish'an Shem Hashem, Hu K'migdal Chazak. The support that the name of God provides is like a mighty tower. V'od Yosef, and it's even more than that. Ki Amischazek B'migdal, Hine Yosef Bo Kalu. A guy who's in a tower is imprisoned, and he can't go anywhere. So, granted, a tower, a fortress, is very secure, but it's also very constricting, right? And the guy, you know, there's a certain fortitude that comes with that, but there's also a certain isolation. Aval b'mishan shem Hashem yoritz hatzadik b'chol makom shiyirtze u'mischazik sham. But the guy who's connected to God has both milus. He is protected and he's secure, just like the tower. But he can also, as the pasuk says, bo yorutz tzadik v'niskav. He's able to run wherever he wants. That feeling of constriction doesn't come about from the connection to the Shem Hashem.
Or cabin view.
What's v'niskav mean?
Niskav means elevated.
Elevated.
Right. So. So this idea, I mean, the double idea that the Mitzvot David brings out is a tremendously important hashkafa to convey to people, and particularly, you know, it's true for young people, probably true for adults as well. You know, there's a tremendous tendency to see Judaism as being a source, like the Migdal. In other words, it's a source of strength. It's a source of protection against the forces of the outside world. But you pay a price for that. You know, this is the way I think a lot of people look at it. It's a very constricting kind of lifestyle.
Some might think that's a good thing.
Yeah, okay, in Achinami. But, you know, when people... Again, in my own experience, you know, dealing with people, you know, the tightness that people tend to have against Yiddishkeit is that, you know, it prevents me from doing all the sort of things that I would want to do. I feel walled in.
That's cabin fever.
But
right. Yeah.
On the other hand, if you're part of a community, I immediately think of Hasidic communities, right. But it could be any community that has shares a certain set of values and so on. It, to a certain extent, makes it easier to conform, I guess, and go with the flow.
It makes it easier, but there are plenty of drop.
It's insulated.
But there are plenty of dropouts from insular communities also. I mean, you know, there was a book that was written a couple of years back, you know, that depicted a chassid walking over the Brooklyn Bridge. I think it was the Brooklyn Bridge, if I'm not mistaken, right? In other words, and basically leaving. It was Williamsburg, I think it was the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, leaving everything behind. I you know, and I've met plenty of such people, you know, as much as you try to create an insular world, you know, you're limited in the fact that the world at large is not an insular place. I mean, you know, if you want to, there are plenty of opportunities to get out of that insular world and, you know, to leave everything behind. You know, so the hashkafa, which I think, again, it's an easy thing to say, it's a lot harder thing to do, but the hashkafa, which I think we want to instill in Talmidim and children, in other people, in adults, is basically that it's Yiddishkeit is both. It's a migdal oz, it's a solid fortress, but at the same time, bo yarutz, it's something which ultimately is not. Look, obviously there are restrictions, right? But those restrictions are elevating for the person. I mean, the same way we say that, you know, when a person eats with table manners, yes, it's restricting in a certain sense. But, you know, it's restrictions that are elevating for the person. You know, if you ate with your hands, you know, like a horse, yeah, it gives you more freedom on a certain level, but it also takes away from the dignity of the human being. You know, what all of the restrictions of Shabbos and Kashrus and, you know, Taharas HaMishpacha and Lashon Hara and all these sort of things do for us is that they elevate the personal dignity which we possess. They make us godly people, you know, as opposed to being human beings who were stuck down in the mire. We've become kedoshim through these things. These are not things which are meant to restrict us. They're supposed to bring out the highest form of potential that we have as human beings. Right? So they're both... that's the perspective on Torah and Mitzvahs. The Shem Hashem, to be connected to the name of God, is to simultaneously be able to have this tremendous sense of security and to ward off the forces in the world that look to... that look to distance us from God, and at the same time, it gives us this sense of freedom. You know, what do you mean? You have a sense of freedom? We have the sense of freedom in the sense that we're able to actualize our full potential as kedoshim, which we wouldn't be able to do if we were just, you know, if we didn't have Shabbos and Kashrus and all of these other quote unquote restrictions that were pulling us down.
It's great. I take a simple example, like TV.
Yeah,
TV. I don't know how simple. Maybe it's very potentially dangerous TV. I don't know. But, I mean, how much of this is nurture and how much of this is nature? It interests me because, like, you know, we have a son and a daughter, as you know, and our son, he for some reason never watched TV. Yeah. Never watched TV.
Right.
Because of he wants to insulate himself from whatever TV is. He doesn't even really probably... I don't know, is that the ideal? Is that the ideal situation? Not TV in particular, but I guess that's what we're saying here. The more you insulate and the more you surround yourself with halach, with the hashkafa of mitzvos and other hashkafic things, the more you surround yourself with God's name. And that's the ideal situation?
Or? Well, I think that's a separate issue from over here. Notice what we're saying over here is that you should realize that mitzvos are simultaneously a protection, but they're dafka not restrictive in the ultimate sense. In other words, even though they involve many restrictions, they enable us to have a certain kind of spiritual freedom that we wouldn't have had otherwise. And that's, in fact, let me just... I think the word v'niskav, you know, elevated, is a key word over here. Why do we mention that he's a tzaddik v'niskav? So tzaddik just means you do what's right. Niskav means that somehow the person is elevated. And I think that goes back to what we were saying before, that the various restrictions that we see as restrictions imposed upon the person, but they really serve to elevate the person and give him the sense of freedom, of ritzo, being able to run around spiritually wherever he wants. It's not just simply a fortress which is protecting him, but something which allows him to flourish and be creative in a religious sense.
Sort of which
is coming back to Marty's point for a minute.
Yeah. Well, you can touch
I think it's a different issue, an important issue, but a different issue as to what degree of insularity is helpful and what degree of insularity is hurtful.
Yeah, that's my point, not to interrupt you right around, but like, for example, the yeshiva, the girls' yeshiva, they make an assignment, a research report, and they put out an edict, do not use the internet.
Right.
Which, so I mean,
it's a little more difficult.
So I mean, is that maybe if that's a separate topic, if that's a separate point, then I want to, you know, explore that point a little bit. What is that? Is that the idea? You know, that's a very difficult. When I hear that, I'm not sure that's a higher spiritual plane.
Right.
Well, I just want to say, like, I think your son is following the Vilna Gaon in a way.
Yeah.
He didn't watch TV either.
That's true.
And the Dubna Magid.
Yeah.
He was friends with the Dubna Magid, right? So the Dubna Magid was known to give Teuchacha. He was excellent at it, you know. So for some reason, the Vilna Gaon thought that he needs Teuchacha, you know. Even though he was the Vilna Gaon and he was full of, you know, Rosh Hashanah, he's above everybody. But still, he felt that to perfect himself, he felt he needed a second opinion. So the Dubna, you want to tell him over the book? All right, so the Dubna, it's a famous maestro.
Yeah, that's fine.
So the Dubna Magid said to him, he says, where are you, the Vilna Gaon? In this room here, you're surrounded with Svarim. You're surrounded by Talmidei Chachamim. You're surrounded by people that ask you Shailas and Shuvah. You don't get involved in Shailas and Shuvahs. Let's see, you go out in the Shuk with his distractions, with his Yitzharas, and let's see, you beat a Vilna Gaon over there. You're living an insulated life. So, I mean, I heard there were two answers. First, I heard that he cried. In other words, there was some truth to what he said. And then he says, I'm not a kunstler. I'm not a magician. I'm not a juggler. I can't juggle, you know, the outside world. I think I told the Rebbe correctly.
Yeah.
And the fact that they say that they had an exit from the shul that he learned, there were two exits.
Right.
And one that went out into the street, and one that went out like to an alleyway. So he always took the alleyway because he wanted to avoid. I mean, even to the point of leaving a shul, he was consistent with his shita.
Those two answers are actually, in a sense, you know, some of the dividing lines between different parts of Orthodoxy today. You know, I mean, to what extent was the Vilna Gaon makabel the Divrei Musar of the Maggid? To what extent did he say no? I don't think that's correct. I mean, in very, very, very general terms. I mean, I'll tell you know what I think.
Rav Kook was the opposite of that. Well, I mean, he went out into the Shuk.
Yeah.
I mean, he went out to the Kibbutzim. He went out to the Netanf Ruma. He was the exact opposite.
I mean, I'll tell you what I think, and you know, you can take it for whatever it's worth.
Yeah.
One point I think is that the degree of relative insularity that a person should have is somewhat up to the individual. In other words, what works for one person or one group of people is not going to work for the other person. You know, and again, a lot of that, I mean, everyone comes from different backgrounds, everyone's been exposed to different things. You know, you take somebody who's been exposed to the secular world to a very wide degree, and then you say, okay, you have to sit in a shtibel mea sharim, that's going to be the rest of your life, and you know, you're not going to have anything to do with your past. You know, psychologically, that's probably not a healthy thing for the person to do. I mean, if it's even possible. I mean, at a certain point, the person's probably going to explode from that. Mm. You know, so a lot of that, you know, there has to be a lot of attention to the individual in terms of what kind of insularity is desirable or not. I think in general, you know, I mean, obviously, when you're talking about a large group of people, you have to try to figure out, you know, as much as it depends for the individual, you have to try to prescribe something for the larger group. I think you have to strike a certain degree of a balance. I mean, I'll tell you, like, Lamashal Bayos, we were very committed, you know, not to have a TV in the house. you know, because we felt that most of what's on television is ranges from basically neutral value to negative value, right?
In other words,
right? In other words, you know, the degree of positive things that one can glean from TV, you know, that you wouldn't be able to glean from, you know, okay, you want to watch a National Geographic. I can't tell you there's anything particularly wrong with it. But you know what? If you really feel strong enough about that, so go out. You know, nowadays you can go out, you can actually get that, you know, that DVD that has the program on it and just watch it as a separate thing to itself. You know, so we thought that, you know, that was something that, you know, we would rather not expose ourselves, the kids, you know, the family to. When it comes to the internet, I find it hard to, you know, again, even though there are circles today with a very anti-internet, I find it hard to imagine how people can function in the world today, you know, without it. That's not to say that there's not a tremendous amount of dangers that are associated with the internet. I mean, again, because you have exposure to everyone and everything without any filtering whatsoever. You can meet up any mishugana in the world, and dangerous mishuganas, you know, through exposure to the internet. I think there definitely has to be some, not just some, but a lot of monitoring and filtering, and a lot of, you know, obviously for children, but I think even for adults, because again, we know plenty of stories about adults who, you know, just, they were surfing on the web and they found something and it was interesting, and something ended up in their email box and they just followed a link and they went here, and all of a sudden, you know, they're cheating on their wives, you know, I mean, you have a lot of stories like that, unfortunately, and, you know, as adults we have to be cognizant of that. But, you know, to say that, you know, we assert it altogether, I think you're opening yourself up for a fall, because it's a dove eshein atzibur yachol la'amud bo. I mean, it's something which is just not, in 2009 and in 2019 and in 2029, you know, that's the way already at this point the world runs on the internet. You can't shut it out. I mean, it's kind of like shutting out telephones, you know, at this point. You know, you might as well, you know, I mean, telephones have a tremendous potential for evil also with all the people that you could reach. But, I mean, there has to, you know, at a certain point, if you're going to shut out everything, there's going to be a backlash which is not going to be healthy for people either. You know, there has to be an ability to teach people how to take the ideals of Torah and work with the society we have, with the good, with the bad, and somehow manage to, you know, to balance that. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's easier said than done, but I think, you know, again, in the societies and the communities, the firm communities where there's quote unquote a total ban on the internet, first of all, it's not a ban. You know, I mean, you know, the places that, you know, we won't have a website because we don't believe in the internet. Yeah, you don't have a website, but if you need to get in touch with me, you know, here's my email address. You know, so what kind of message are you sending? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's a message of hypocrisy. It's not a very healthy message. But again, it has to be treated with a tremendous amount of caution. There is a tremendous amount of bad which is out there, which is accessible through the internet, and you know, we have to be very cognizant of that as well. So that's my take, you know, yeah. For the for whatever it's worth.
To Marty's point about the TV.
Yeah.
I think what that represents is instant gratification, as
Absolutely.
Opposed to Torah values, for example, where you have to cultivate, I think, you have to cultivate an appreciation. It just, very often, you're raised, for example, those of us who've been raised with Shabbos. So Shabbos, and it's not until, at least in my experience, and later on in life, when you really say, gee, you know, how does the non-Jewish world function without it?
Right. Absolutely. And the truth is, it's a very big problem for Chinuch, because since everyone is used to instant gratification, through TV, through the internet, you know, through emails and cell phones where, you know, I get a response. I heard on the radio recently that a certain company, you know, when they send out bids via the internet, you know, via email, they only take responses that come back within 2 minutes. Because if you're going to respond after 2 minutes, obviously you're too slow, you know, to be able to do the kind of business that we do. So we live in a very high-pressured world. I mean, that's why so many people have nervous breakdowns, you know, because it's a very high-pressured world. And, you know, that applies to Torah. I mean, Torah, right, I mean, you can't get Torah like this, you know. I mean, it takes a lot of effort, and you won't get it the first time. You have to chazer it. And, you know, it's doing terrible things in chinuch, you know, this high-pressured, instant gratification world in which we live. Because you know, Torah doesn't work like that. You know, I know in giving shir, I tried as much as possible, you know, to put things into quote-unquote bite-size packages, you know. Yeah, but I mean, to a large extent, that's because that's what the generation needs, you know, because, okay, we have a question, there are three answers, boom, 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 you know, and then you remember that, and now you have a piece of information. Right, and now, you know, let's go on to the next topic, you know, question, two answers, you know, and again, you know, it helps. I mean, I think, you know, you got to go to the people where they are, but certainly, I mean, you look at Rav Moshe's Dibros Moshe, right, where on, you know, any topic he would write for 25, 30 pages. People don't have the patience to read that anymore. You know, people don't have the patience to figure it out. People don't have the patience. You know, people want Vatara sheets. You know, the question is, the answer is, the question is, the answer is. You know, that's how we function
well,
nowadays.
Each door had a, I mean, like, when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, so the Torah Shabbat Pad was in trouble.
Right.
So they had to put, had a...
Yeah, 100%. You got to work with what you have.
Each door has a problem.
You got to work with what you have. But, I mean, that's...
You got to apply the technique of that door.
100%. Okay, we'll see you, Bez Hashem, next Sunday.
Shukriya.